Repression and brutality by authorities is increasing against protesters. Raids on workshops and meeting places took place in Washington, D.C., and then Philadelphia. In Philly, young people with an unconventional style of dress have been picked up and interrogated as police fish for inside information about protesters' plans. Earlier this week in Minneapolis, 11 activists were subjected to a police raid which would have done any totalitarian dictatorship proud. On July 25th, several hundred unarmed protesters clashed with police armed with batons, helmets, and pepper spray during a demonstration against a conference of the International Society of Animal Genetics, ISAG. Photographs on the Indie Media website clearly show protesters dressed in shorts and t-shirts being attacked with clubs by armored police. Later that evening, masked local and federal police raided a house belonging to a nonprofit group called the Sisters of Camelot, which distributes food to the poor and was used as a center for organizing for the ISAG protests. Police used a warrant obtained under the auspices of finding evidence of drug trafficking. The warrant was dated July 21st, 4 days before the protest, and covers the seizure of, quote, narcotic drugs and controlled substances including but not limited to marijuana, also drug paraphernalia, monies and property obtained from illegal sales of these controlled substances, weighing and packaging materials, property bartered and traded for these controlled substances, firearms, ammunitions, and other weapons to protect the narcotic sales operation, radio and telecommunication devices to facilitate narcotic sales, and photographic and other records such as computers, laptops, and electronic notebooks of drug sales and or use. Close quote. In short, any items the police want to seize that might be found in any home. The use of phony drug busts against political activists is not new. It was used extensively in the 1960s against activist groups as part of the FBI's COINTELPRO operation. And by all accounts, the FBI is at it again. Here is an eyewitness account of the raid by one of the arrested activists. It contains strong language which I have not removed as it would impact the news value of the item. Please turn off your radio if you are offended by such language. According to a release distributed by the Bioengineering Action Network, quote, a large gang of law enforcement busted through the front door of the Sisters Camelot house screaming and telling people to get on your faces. Apparently, no one moved fast enough as the police threw people down and kicked them. Robert Zernick was referred to by the police by his nickname Tumbleweed and kicked repeatedly in his face until he stopped moving. When he didn't answer the police, they shoved their knuckles into his throat and continued kicking him. When he requested first aid, he was laughed at. Another person was beaten in the basement by about 10 police officers. After approximately 15 minutes of extremely high tension, they forced us to sit up, covered our heads with ripped banners, property of people in the house, and proceeded to tear the house apart. They said they had to cover our eyes so that we wouldn't be able to see their undercover officers. Three or more undercover officers were present, wearing thick black ski masks and sunglasses. This was all under the pretense of a drug raid, but they gathered materials from the ISAG counterconference and referred to us as the ISAG bunch. For the next 2 hours, they consistently brought up ISAG and animal rights issues. They also taunted us about the pet turtle that lives in the house, and among other things said, quote, you're not so tough now, are ya? This is a police state. You'll have had this coming for a while. Save the turtles. Stop moving or I'll fucking kill you. close quote. When asked what we were being charged with, they ignored us or refused to answer the questions, instead citing, quote, "You don't answer our questions, we won't answer yours." They refused to show us a search warrant. We sat there for 2 hours, handcuffed and hooded, all the while being taunted and degraded by the police. I believe 11 people were arrested. Robert Cernick was finally taken out by a police EMT, and the rest of us were transported to the Hennepin County Jail. 2 people are still being held on, quote, probable cause, unquote, for alleged narcotics possession. Items taken from the house included 3 computer hard drives, ISAG patches, activist literature, floppy disks, files, and a bus used as a mobile kitchen in food distribution. Musical instruments and other personal items were broken. Another account by freelance writer Jeremy David Stolen was written based on interviews with the arrested activists. He describes the experience of a young woman arrested in the raid. He wrote, "A female activist, who will be called T, was at the Sisters Camelot house on Monday with about 10 others, watching local news coverage of the day's protests against ISAG. This was her first protest, and she was quite exhausted from the previous 2 days of activity. At the time of the raid, she was simply sitting in a chair, talking with the other people gathered there, many of whom had been involved in the protests. Shortly after the news was over, a Minneapolis police officer in riot gear appeared in the living room with shield and padded vest and was followed by more. The first officer demanded that everyone, quote, get down on the ground and put your hands behind your head, close quote. After T was lying down, she was kicked 4 to 5 times in the thigh. When the police were asked about a warrant or reason for the search, they said they had a warrant and would leave a copy behind when they left. Other inquiries were answered with, shut up. A bag was placed over T's head as she was lying face down on the ground, and she was very frightened. She could hear what sounded like others being beaten or kicked, and indeed blood was spilled. Everyone was also cuffed with plastic or metal handcuffs. The police searched the activists one by one in the bathroom, 1 officer per activist. As a female officer was bringing T to the bathroom, another officer remarked that, quote, she's one of the ones we want, unquote. T surmises that this comment was related to her frontline involvement in the afternoon protests and her appearance on television as such. In the bathroom, she was patted down but not strip or cavity searched. The officer also searched T's bag. T is unable to share any information about the appearance of the female officer because the officer was wearing a mask that covered her entire face, except for her eyes and the top of her nose. 2 to 4 officers total were wearing masks during the raid, and activists say they recognized them from the previous 2 days of marches, which these officers attended in plain clothes, quote, undercover. The presence of undercover personnel was confirmed when a man was spotted video recording the events from across the street. An activist overheard an officer say, quote, somebody tell that guy we have undercover agents here, close quote. However, the cameraman was allowed to continue filming after he was questioned. At least 2 federal agents from the Drug Enforcement Agency participated in the raid, and were readily identifiable as such by their uniforms, which said DEA. The law enforcement affiliation of at least 2 others was unclear, but activists suspected they were FBI because of the deference with which the Minneapolis police officers treated them. The presence, actions, and allegations of FBI agents in Minneapolis in connection with the protests has been well documented in the mainstream local media. And that was from an article by freelance writer Jeremy David Stolen, based on interviews with activists arrested in Minneapolis on July 25th. The police and those who direct their activities are responding to the protests planned for the Democratic and Republican conventions by requisitioning millions of dollars worth of weaponry to use against the protesting citizenry. While this is sure to have a chilling effect on some participants, other direct actionists are taking it in stride. V-Man of Free Radio Santa Cruz spoke with Matt Rubin of the R2K Network about plans for the actions beginning this week. By the way, for those not attending, WEOS will carry daily special programs on the convention activity in Philadelphia starting at 8 a.m. and also at 1 p.m. The Indie Media website at www.indiemedia.org will carry round-the-clock reports.
Okay, this is the V-Man for 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm on the phone today with Matt Rubin of the Philadelphia Direct Action Group and the umbrella group R2K Network. How you doing today, Matt?
All right, how you doing?
Good. If you could just go ahead and start by telling us a little bit about the Philadelphia Direct Action Group and the R2K Network and how that's all come together.
Sure. The R2K Network, it's an umbrella group of organizers, coordinators, and activists, and we're planning demonstrations, education, and agitation before and during the Republican National Convention here in Philadelphia. The R2K Network includes a broad variety of groups, including the major organizations who are organizing the major demonstrations and direct action events right before and during the convention. This includes the Ad Hoc Committee to Defend Healthcare and Unity 2000, and these are two groups that are having marches on the 29th and 30th of July to protest for single-payer healthcare in the case of the first one, in the case of Unity, for a variety of issues ranging from racial equality to women's issues to class issues and a whole variety of issues. It also includes the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, which is having a Poor People's Economic Human Rights March on the 31st of July, which is going to be poor people standing up for themselves along with supporters to bring light the number of poor people, the 35 million poor people who live in this country, and the issues facing them, including police repression, welfare reform, and a host of other issues. And it also includes the Independent Media Center, which folks may be familiar from with its guises in Seattle and Washington, D.C., and the IMC is doing a great job of informing folks of what's going on the ground and hosting a number of events and acting as a general kind of heartbeat and nerve center for information around this. And, of course, the Philadelphia Direct Action Group, which is a coalition that's organizing direct action events during the second and third and probably fourth days of the convention, August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And the Philadelphia Direct Action Group is going to be doing direct action in protest of the convention, very similar to what folks saw in Washington in particular. Puppets and street theater, people sitting down in streets and blocking streets, protesting in various areas regardless of whether or not there's a permit, and generally doing the kind of the sort of new style demonstrations and taking it to the streets that we saw in Seattle and Washington.
Now, you talked briefly about the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and their march on the 31st. I believe they were denied a permit to march by the City of Philadelphia?
Yes, the City of Philadelphia has not granted a permit for anyone to do anything, really, during the actual convention days. And the Kensington Welfare Rights Union is very prominent in this because they officially applied for a permit through all the channels, and they were explicitly denied that permit for their march.
Hmm.
Their march is going to go on anyway. It's going to convene on the 31st at City Hall, literally right dead smack in the heart of Philadelphia, and they're going to march from City Hall down Broad Street, the major northwest street in Philadelphia, down to the convention.
And where is the convention at? At the Staples?
The convention is at the First Union Center.
First Union Center.
Staples, you're thinking of L.A.
L.A., you're right.
They're all named after some big corporation. It's at the First Union Center, which is in South Philadelphia in what we call a sports complex.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And that's pretty much been cordoned off of like a virtual fortress. But as I said, the Direct Action Group is going to be having all kinds of direct action events around the convention and probably will include stuff down there as well.
Now, I was wondering if you could go into a little bit about Spiral Q. I also am aware of they had been shut down earlier last week. And
people who followed the events in Washington probably remember when the Convergence Center was raided there by the police the night before one of the major protest days. And we had a taste of that in Philadelphia this past Friday, the 22nd, when Spiral Q, which is a community nonprofit puppet theater, which has been around for several years, was temporarily shut down by the Philadelphia Department of Licensing and Inspections for alleged fire and electrical codes. The important thing to understand is that when the person who runs Spiral Q, Matthew Hart, when he came into his office at 9 in the morning, his doors were unlocked and ajar, and he had certainly not done that. No one who works there had done that, and across the street, there were unidentified men taking photographs. Then later in the day, the Department of Licensing and Inspections came, and again, we had the unidentified men taking photographs and automobiles with covered-up license plates and a whole kind of host of police, covert police surveillance and intimidation tactics. They temporarily shut it down in the afternoon, and the mayor's office actually intervened to get it reopened, and the landlord did some quick repairs, and now they have access to that again. And the reason it was reopened is basically because they looked really bad in the press because they had shut down a puppet theater, after all. I mean, this is, you can't get more legal and harmless in the eyes of you know, the public than a puppet theater. And also because the landlord of the building that Spiral Q is in is a major developer dumping $30 million into that particular block, and, you know, money talks. And so in this case, it worked for us. But this is one example of intimidation and harassment. And the strategy, as it was in part in Washington, is definitely to try to intimidate and harass beforehand, to try to diffuse the impact of the protests as much as possible beforehand.
I was also wondering what plans are being taken in preparation for possible police misconduct at this point. I'm aware of a beating which was televised nationally a few weeks ago by Philadelphia police, and I also understand that an unarmed African-American was recently shot down in Philadelphia.
At the train station, yes. There's definitely been events involving the police unrelated to this convention that have shown the country what police violence can look like very vividly, and has shone a light on the culture of policing in Philadelphia, which is certainly not unique in the country, but it's definitely up there with police departments to be feared and police departments that have engaged in violence in Philadelphia's case for decades, ever since the regime of the former police commissioner and Mayor Frank Rizzo, if not before that. There's only so much that we can do. What we are doing is we're laying the groundwork with the public and the police and the media by emphasizing that, as in Washington, we have set up an organizing framework that is nonviolent and does not include property destruction. And as in Washington, we're asking everyone who comes down to join the protest to respect that framework. And as in Washington, we anticipate that they will. That's one thing. So we're making it clear that if anything violent happens, it's not going to be us. It's going to be the police.
Right.
And that has been fairly effective, especially because the police are a bit on the defensive because of the incidents you mentioned. It's definitely made it more difficult for them to put themselves up as kind of innocent victims of protesters and that sort of a thing. So we're doing that, and of course we're organizing to be prepared for this. The police have been saying that they are not going to use violence, that they want everything to be calm and safe, but of course we don't know what they're actually going to do.
Right.
So we're organizing to anticipate that there will be violence. So we're training people in nonviolent direct action. We're training people in how to try to avoid violence and how to minimize as much as possible their exposure to violence. But, you know, at some point, we live in a democracy, and that means you put yourself out there, and we have to just hope that they will use restraint and they won't use the pepper spray and the tear gas and the billy clubs and beatings that they've used in Seattle and Washington. We really don't have control over all of it.
I know in L.A., a confidential police report surfaced with a whole host of weapons and equipment that they have requested, including 40,000 pepper ball rounds. Has anything like that been surfaced in Philadelphia?
We know that the Philadelphia police have spent, as far as we know, over $1 million on equipment. Most of that, as far as we know, is like riot gear or some tear gas equipment. Certainly ominous equipment, but nothing quite as distinctive as the pepper balls or, from what I've heard, the rubber bullets that the mayor in L.A. has threatened to use. We haven't heard anything about those types of things in particular, but we have heard and seen reports of massive police budget increases for riot gear and things associated with that. So, and, you know, there's ominous stories in the news as well. For example, there was just a big drill with local hospital and fire and police and safety personnel simulating a sarin nerve gas attack. And, you know, this is being done, you know, to project an image of readiness, but it's also, of course, being done to say either implicitly or explicitly that they're expecting, you know, terrorism and violence. And, of course, that's not the case. But by doing that sort of thing and by and by spinning as they have, saying, well, we're rolling out the red carpet for the delegates and for the protesters, but, you know, there could be a few bad seeds like there were in Seattle. By taking this kind of spin, which, of course, wasn't true for Seattle either, they are trying to provide an alibi ahead of time for anything that they might do.
And also,
we find that actually more alarming than the overt attempts to call us all terrorists, because people know that's ridiculous. So these are things we find much more savvy and much more frightening.
And it instills fear in a large population like Philadelphia, I mean,
absolutely.
In the citizens
absolutely.
Of the city.
Absolutely. And it makes our job harder, absolutely. But, you know, the media here have been very willing to cover us and to listen to us, and, you know, they're definitely a bit heavy on the whole protester versus police angle, and it's a struggle to get our actual message out. But other than that, I have to say the media have been pretty fair so far.
That's good news. I have one final question, and has the convergence of activists and demonstrators begun at this point?
Oh, yes. The convergence started this past Monday, July 24th, and if folks are on the Internet, they can go to a couple of websites that has totally comprehensive information, including exactly where to check in, where the convergence spaces are, where the trainings are, when they are, what they're about. It has everything. And if I could give you those website addresses.
Oh, please.
Okay. The Philadelphia Direct Action Group website is www.thepartysover.org, and that's just as if it's all one word, THEPARTYSOVER. And that has convergence information and a calendar and phone numbers for all different kinds of things like media, logistics, medical care. It has all the trainings on it. Then there's the R2K Network's overall website, which is www.r2kphilly.org, r2kphilly.org. That has, again, a really comprehensive calendar, even more comprehensive than the PDAG website, also the training stuff. It also has summaries of and web links to every group that is organizing for this convention, and it's a really great resource. So people can find everything they need at those two websites.
All right. Matt Rubin from the R2K Network, I want to thank you for your hard work and putting this incredible amount of work together for the Republican convention.
Well, thanks for helping us get the word out. And, you know, we can't wait to join all of our comrades and colleagues who are streaming in as we speak. And we think it's going to be great.
All right. Good luck to you guys on Monday.
Okay. Thank you.
And that was Matt Rubin of the R2K Network, interviewed by V-Man, a free radio Santa Cruz in California. Congress has just increased the military budget by $21 billion. What is this money for? Millions of dollars in federal grants are going to local police departments to outfit them with military-type gear under the guise of the drug war and anti-terrorism. Might the real enemy be us? Would the U.S. military fire on a crowd of demonstrating citizens? What do you think? In light of the situation, activists must consider how to achieve justice when one's opponents are brutal, bristling with weapons, and protected by law. The debate has become so hysterical at times that illegality has become synonymous with violence. Just to clarify, these are the only legal avenues open to you as a demonstrator. You must stay on the sidewalk, but not block it, or receive a permit if you intend to march in the street. If you do, you will be flanked by police officers. Your permit will specify an end time, and if you continue your march or rally beyond that time, you are subject to arrest. In many places, the actual composition of your protest signs and banners is specified by the authorities. You may not enter private property, such as the lobby of a corporate building, without the permission of the owner, or you are subject to arrest. If you gather in a public park in a large group, you are liable to be subject to police harassment, or at least questioning. You may pass out leaflets as long as you stand on public property. You may stand on the sidewalk and make a speech. If a crowd of any size gathers around you, in most cities, it will be broken up for blocking the sidewalk. If you're yelling too loud, you may be arrested for causing a nuisance. Here is a list of some criminal protest activities. blocking the entrance to a building or occupying a building which you don't own and refusing to leave, hanging a banner from a public or private structure, walking in the street other than in crosswalks, refusing to follow the command of a police officer. Under loitering and vagrancy laws on the books in most cities, police may stop and question anyone, though in practice it is unlikely to happen to you if you are white and garbed in conventional business attire. In the following article, Professor Dave Berkman of Madison, Wisconsin, suggests ways that 21st century computer technology can be used to devastating effect and bring the corporate world order to its knees without firing a single shot.
21st Century Electronic Anarchy by Dave Berkman. Finally, the third world's economically exploited now possess the weapon to bring down the transnational corporate giants that have dominated and trapped them in perpetual peonage. And not just those economic monsters, but the industrialized countries and their residents who fostered their creation, enacted the laws, and provided the financing to empower them to continue in their rapacious greed. Which means, above all others, the United States. The corporate giants of the industrialized world are now wholly dependent upon their computers. But those devices are not only electronic assemblages that can be used to slash workforces, organize and direct infrastructures, and aggregate the information without which those companies wouldn't be able to operate. They are also their Achilles heels. The computers, machines, and communication systems they operationally control can now be brought down in an instant, from anywhere in the world, by any marginally talented programmer trained in a fly-by-night computer trade school in Manila, Sucre, or Nairobi. Since that evens the playing field, it can be argued that this also constitutes justice. Those aghast at what I'm suggesting will call it anarchy. That's because when the strong use their economic dominance to exploit the labor of those who reside in the backward and emerging nations, and to poison them and their children by pillaging their environment, they are acting legally. They use their money and influence to make the laws and treaties that favor and protect their interests, so of course they are. But when the weak visit the same ruination on the corporations that have visited ruin on them, they are acting outside the law. In other words, if it's legal and oppressive, it's okay. But if it's illegal and directed against oppressors, it's anarchy. And anarchy, at least by Western definition, is wrong. Think of what a moderately talented hacker can do. Think back to what the Armageddon types feared about Y2K. Everything could go under. There'd be no electrical generation, no lighting, no heating or air conditioning, no elevators, no air traffic control, no traffic lights, no trains. Gasoline pumps and telephones would fail. Health services would be rendered inoperable. Broadcast stations would go off the air. Water, sanitation, and pumping facilities would crash. Corporate and personal financial records would all disappear, and all the computers themselves would cease to function. Those of us who reside in the industrialized West would find ourselves living without not just the conveniences, but the necessities, all the things that the corporate might of the industrialized world has forced the billions residing in the nations they exploit to exist without. I know that if I were a Filipino, a Bolivian, or Tanzanian who lived among a people for whom laws and treaties imposed on my nation meant physical, economic, and intellectual poverty, I'd see no legitimacy to the legalities designed only to protect the rights of my oppressors to continue their oppression. 50 years ago, such injustices inspired the oppressed to form armed revolutionary movements dedicated to forceful overthrow of their oppressors. But the superior military might of the West and the traitorous puppets in the emerging nations whom the capitalist world shored up guaranteed the obliteration of such movements and the deaths of those who joined their ranks. Once, such revolutionary movements might have at best achieved an occasional success of overrunning an army base, blowing up a factory, or burning down a plantation. But today, with a few keystrokes, a 21st century revolutionary can disable the computers that control the corporations, which shore up oppressive militaristic regimes and exploit factory and plantation labor. And once those disabled computers are debugged and brought back online, third world hackers can just as quickly devise new programs that will continuously render such damages. What Marxist revolutionaries could not achieve in a 20th century industrial world, a few hundred hackers in an electronically dependent 21st century can realize almost instantaneously. If all this seems like semi-coherent ranting, it comes across so only because it originates from someone residing in an industrial advanced nation, which is the chief enemy of the world's oppressed. The likelihood of someone like myself engaging in such electronic anarchy is, of course, nil. I mean, here I am sitting comfortably as I compose this string of words on my Microsoft operating system-equipped compact laptop for transmission by my AOL-owned ISP over an Ameritech phone line. But as that Filipino creator of the I Love You bug proved, granted he may not have been personally motivated by any radical social, political, or economic agenda, a relative handful of electronic anarchists who are so motivated could thrust a computer-dependent high-tech Western world into third-world chaos in a matter of nanoseconds. Dave Berkman is a retired University of Wisconsin at Madison mass communications professor and host of Media Talk on WHAD-FM.
Street protests are by no means the only way that the have-nots can take on the power of the haves. First of all, there are far more of us. The power of the rulers is built on the labor of the ruled, and especially here in America, on the perpetuation of consumerism that keeps us on a treadmill. Dave Neal is the editor of the Anarchy for Anybody website. He suggests a few easy and educational exercises to free your mind.
We're not citizens. We're not human beings. We're all consumers. That's what we're supposed to be. Billions of advertising dollars are spent pitching products we don't want and services we don't need. How many ads do you see in one day? Have you ever taken time to count them? On and on so much that it becomes background noise. For-profit corporations own the airwaves, the presses, the massive media, in other words. They own it, and therefore they control it. They deliver you, the audience, as product for their clients, the advertisers. That may seem ass backwards, right? You think you're the client buying the product, whether a sitcom or a magazine or a newspaper, but you're not. Those shows and magazines are just bait to get you to swallow their advertising cheese. That's how for-profit media beat out working-class media. They did it through advertising revenue. The old working-class presses relied on subscriptions, whereas ad-based media could write off the costs because they were getting money from companies wanting to sell their products to you. A tidy, effective arrangement, especially when you have a mass of people who just have a knee-jerk response to advertising. You don't know why you picked up those breath mints or chewing gum or fried chicken. It just caught your eye. The fact is that advertising works. The industry wouldn't spend billions annually if it didn't work. It underpins the consumer culture that thrives around us. But this same thing is based on the ignorance of the consumer, so what you have to do is become aware of the ads around you. Capitalist society lives or dies on this consumption. Fortunes are made and lost on it. Well, more fortunes are made than lost because people consume so much, it's really like shooting fish in a barrel. What the average person needs is advertising inoculation. Take a step back and defend yourself from the barrage of advertising. Advertising is propaganda. The only difference is that it is for economic interests and not political ones. But the methodologies remain the same. Viewing advertising as propaganda, you can see that our society is inundated with propaganda on a level that would make Stalin green with envy. People usually consider propaganda bad. They see it as manipulative and misinformative, but somehow advertising doesn't really get the same treatment. It's seen as harmless, even entertaining. But if you trace people's buying habits to advertising, you can see the very real harm behind it all. Say Nike and Gap and their constant ads and use of sweatshop labor. The ads increase purchases of their product and ensure that those sweatshops keep on humming to meet the demand. Those are very real consequences. Even more perverse, people often shell out big money to wear advertising slogans and symbols on their persons. That's the epitome of sickness, paying for the privilege to become a walking billboard. When ads become status symbols or fashion accessories, you know you've got a sick culture on your hands. And what about those programs about advertisements, like the world's funniest ads or the Clio Awards for advertising excellence? People wasting their lives and time watching programs about ads like they were a form of entertainment themselves. I recall many people saying, "Oh, I don't watch the Super Bowl for the game. I watch it for the ads." Does that seem wrong to you? It seems wrong to me. In the consumer culture, you are what you buy, you are what you own. The less you own, the less you are. That's the ideal arrangement, and it's a crock. No way for a human being to live at all. What's worse, corporations are busy infiltrating schools with their ad campaigns and Channel One crap to create a next generation of little consumers out of that captive audience. They're exploiting the continuing financial problems of the education system to their advantage. The best way to waste that money is not to become a consumer. So what can you do to combat this? Maybe you don't want to combat it at all. Maybe you enjoy it. If so, then don't proceed. Just keep on consuming. If you've got the slightest inclination to think for yourself, try the following. Step 1. Counting ads up. Take some time to count how many ads you run across in a day, whether on the radio, television, newspaper, magazine, catalogs, billboards, people's t-shirts, wherever you find one. Just have a scrap of paper handy and keep a tally one day, just to see how much advertising you're exposed to. That's probably a good estimate for what you're exposed to in a week, so multiply it out and see how many ads you're exposed to in a year. Step 2. Watch and learn. Evaluate the ads you see. Take them apart and think about what they're appealing to, what their message is. The message is always the same: buy this product and be cool. For example, a recent car ad I saw showed a bunch of Generation Xers washing cars, and when they saw this baby boomer's fancy car go by, they decided to wash it for free. They thought the car was just so cool. Then the smug boomer stands by with another buddy and says, "That's the third time they washed my car today." If you state the message directly, it ends up being revealed as stupid. Baby boomers, buy this car, and stupid slackers will beat a path to kiss your ass. I noticed a ton of ads are geared toward baby boomers, mostly because they're the largest, most affluent demographic group out there. Anyway, as you think a little about how ads do what they do, you'll begin to see how formulaic they are and what psychological techniques they routinely use to sell products, to better prepare yourself to defend against them. Keep in mind that ads always want you to have a favorable opinion of the product and the company, and very often rely on simple slogans they repeat like a mantra. Did somebody say McDonald's? One of the weirdest ones was Chiquita, which has a nasty human rights record in the Banana Republics it runs, where they say, Chiquita, for over 100 years, quite possibly nature's perfect food. Now here you see a company literally being bananas, trying to weld the product, bananas, with the company name, Chiquita, in your mind. If you looked at what Chiquita has done in Central and South America, I doubt you'd eat another banana. Step 3. Know what you buy and why. Keep track of your buying habits. Why are you buying a given product? Try to trace the thought. What made you decide to throw away money for junk you just purchased? Do you even know? Have you seen the ad somewhere? If so, where? Once you start doing this, you'll be able to spot it. Like you'll see and hear an ad campaign, and suddenly you'll be able to spot the product on people's desks. What really rattles them is if you ask them where they thought to buy that. Most won't know. If you ask them if they saw the ad campaign, they usually won't remember. Those who do will get spooked, which is worthwhile in itself. The ones who remain consumers, drones, they'll basically just get mad at you for pointing it out and will deny that the ad had any role in their purchase decision. Once you become aware of the ads and their influence, you can attempt to deal with them on your own terms. Step 4, remove the brand. Abandon brand loyalty. Don't be a good, reliable consumer. If you're wedded to a brand name, you're a sucker, deriving satisfaction and identity from a company's product. Your self-worth is tied into that product, whether you know it or not. So when Coke and Pepsi have their cola wars, maybe you should just stop drinking their crap altogether. I found people have near religious intensity in their devotion to their soft drinks, like a Coke drinker will get livid at the notion of drinking Pepsi, like the Bloods and the Crips going at it or something. I think that's both funny and sad. Step 5. Buy nothing. Stop buying things that are advertised. Specifically, don't buy something that has an ad for it. Sort of a qualitative boycott. Boycotts scare the hell out of companies, even though they talk about how boycotts don't work. So make your personal boycott stick. Don't buy anything you've seen advertised. It depends on being aware of the ads around you. This gets at the industry at the foundation. Their clout stems from people making purchases based on their advertising. By not purchasing what they are advertising, by not being a consumer, you're screwing with them. Now, this only works if a bunch of people start doing this. Advertising works in volume, in economies of scale. One person not purchasing advertised products doesn't really matter much, but a bunch of people, well, that makes a difference. Companies can't make profits if people won't buy their goods. Now, usually boycotts are tied to something specific. Company X uses slave labor, so don't buy their products. And they're usually in a narrow scope of time. The company then pays lip service to reformist groups and hires a PR firm to clean up its image, and usually the boycott lifts. But a qualitative boycott is another bird entirely. It boycotts the company itself out of sheer spite. Our consumer culture paints purchasing as almost your patriotic duty. If you don't buy stuff, you're bad. Now, I'm not saying don't buy anything, but only that you don't buy stuff that's advertised. Say there's some pants that you really dig from the Gap. Look for them at a thrift store where you can get them for $3 instead of $30, and your money will go to help the thrift store and not the Gap outlet. Or find other ways of getting what you want, whether buying something from a competitor or whatever. The point is to put a disconnect between ad money spent and product sales. Step 6. Keep style, dump fashion. Style comes from the inside. Fashion's on the outside. Fashion is cultural fast food, and if you want to develop yourself as something other than a consumer of it, dump it. Fashion, fad, and trend are dirty words. Currency of the consumer culture that are designed to keep you chasing after the next big thing. So stop running, stop chasing, define who you are on your own terms and not on the terms of fashion moguls and advertising execs. This sounds easy, but it's not. We're always being told what's in and what's out, the conventional wisdom, over and over again, in an endless cycle of splurging and purging. I remember when people would joke about 70s bell-bottoms. These days they call them flares. They said they'd never come back, but they did, with a vengeance. The only constant in the world of fashion is self-abuse and endless external validation. You derive your self-worth from what you own, buy, eat, or wear. And this isn't any way to live. Lose it. Be unfashionable. Be yourself. This is consumer culture heresy because you're always supposed to conform to the dictates of the fashion police, right? It's so bad that even anti-fashion is fashionable in some quarters. Piercings, anyone? The consumer culture can assimilate just about anything that requires external validation of worth. So the way you beat that game is by not playing. Avoid fads, consumer crazes. Can we say Pokemon, anybody? Trends, gimmicks. They're plagues, the product of cultural bankruptcy. Do that and you'll cultivate style, where you decide how and why you look, not what other people think you should look like. The rule of thumb is, if you're in a room full of people who are all the same, you're being fashionable, so stop it. If somebody says, you look like an anarchist, you're doing something very, very wrong. Step 6, fire the media. Dump the mass media. Don't buy newspapers, magazines, or purchase products advertised on broadcast media. Massive media, Time, Newsweek, New York Times, New Yorker, Wall Street Journal, Vogue, Glamour, NPR, Red Book, 17, whatever. Forget about them. Now you might think, geez, how will I be informed? That's buying into the media trap. They're not informing you, they're misinforming you. And if you purchase their products, you're creating the illusion that they're doing their job. They communicate that to their advertisers as audience. 200,000 people read this paper. 1 million people listen to this radio show. This trend is going on as we speak. People continue to purchase fewer media products, and it has alarmed the whiz kids who own and run them. They're caught up in the notion of them being objective, informative news gatherers. But they're really peddling ads for consumers and trying to keep you coming with titillation and scandal. So don't play the game. There's nothing to say you can't read their tripe. Go to a bookstore or a library and read it there. Just don't buy it. Don't subscribe. Leave them in the dirt. If you can't live without your sitcom, that's fine. Just make sure you don't buy anything they're advertising. Watch how long your program lasts if nobody buys the products it's selling. Then you'll see how the media really works. Now, what's the point of this? In the consumer society, the dollar rules over democracy. They like to pretend that the consumer spending patterns are the only legitimate voice of political expression. You like Coke, Levi's, and Chevy's. The people have spoken. Instead, give a vote of no confidence. Do not buy what they're selling. You gain by not blowing money on crap you don't need, if nothing else. Step 8, support alternative media. There are alternative media out there, but they're hard to come by because they don't have the major bucks that the massive media have. But you can find them if you're willing to look hard enough. And that's sort of a helpful rule of thumb for finding them. If you can easily locate them, they're too mainstream. Avoid bogus alternative publications. You can usually spot them by their focus on lifestyle issues and so forth. Alternative media need your support, so support them. Also, try to find micropower radio in your area. This might take some doing on your part, but they're out there. And you can also look into public access television. Perhaps you could start a program there. I'm not sure of the current state of public access these days, but theoretically it's still out there. Step 9, out of focus groups. If you're really feeling malicious, participate in advertising focus groups and give them screwy answers. Have you ever been in one? They pay money for your participation, usually a given amount they think is a suitable bribe, $20, $40, $60, or more if you're wealthier. And then they put you in a room with a really cheery person who will walk you through a talk about their product. There will be a mirrored wall on one side or something like that as the ad people try to gauge your reactions. There are usually some beverages present, too. They want you to feel at ease and important. Now, if enough people are doing steps 1 through 6, the focus groups will be working overtime to try to figure out what the hell is going on, which is why it'd be so cool if you participate in these, taking industry money to mess with their heads and give them crummy information. You have to be careful with this, though. These people are polished psychological manipulators, so if you're too obviously off the wall, they'll likely boot you and exclude you from future focus groups. It doesn't take much to be considered off the wall with corporate types, so try to be convincing. Of course, this will work better as more people become media savvy. If it's just you in the group, then you're going to be marked off as a statistical anomaly. That happened with me during a degree deodorant focus group, where my opinions were totally off the radar of the others in the group. Basically, they all bought brand name deodorants, and I didn't, so I was the, in quotes, freaky one, the statistical blip. So be abnormally normal. Go against what makes sense and stick to it. Give them bad information, but give it honestly and sincerely, and don't let the facilitator or the other members of the focus group talk you around to their point of view. This information they gather will be used to tailor and target ads toward the demographic group they're after. Advertising is all about demographics, so the more you can futz with their attempts to buttonhole an age group, the better. If you're young, 18 to 24, that succulent demographic group for advertisers, they'll really try to play you, and likely they'll think you're a knucklehead because they think young folks are all slackers. So play to that while consciously giving them bad information. Bad information produces bad ads, and that costs the industry money. Step 10, culture jamming. Screw with ads. This is for the artistically inclined, and it's fun. Check out Adbusters for some examples. They're at www.adbusters.org. With current computer technology, scanners, desktop publishing, and graphic design programs, culture jamming is really doable these days. This is something where you have to use your imagination. The hat trick of culture jamming is taking a familiar format, an ad, symbol, or a sign, and while keeping the form intact, you change the substance of it, putting a different message with the familiar format. For example, you could take a Coke ad, like Coke is it, and change it to choke, or Coke is or something like that. Or you could change the graphic of an ad and put some other message. A good culture-jammed ad is one that your everyday consumer might not even notice right away because they're so used to either blowing off ads or passively absorbing the message. As I said, check out Adbusters for some examples because they've been doing this for years. Also, check out Hakeem Bey's essay, Poetic Terrorism, for some interesting ideas.
That was Dave Neal of Anarchy for Anybody. You can read more of Dave's essays on www.radioforall.org/anarchy.
Burgers, fries,
and the undersold!
There's never been a better time to buy.
Your living room is the factory. The product being manufactured is you.
A 49-year-old unidentified man went berserk last night.
Where did she get her view of the world?
Shotgun. 14 people are dead, including three.
Who will be her role models?
Never been a better time to buy.
What values will she have? Whose child is she? Yours or the network's? Take back your children. Turn off the TV.
You've just heard three television uncommercials produced by Adbusters. For more information about Adbusters, please visit their website at www.adbusters.org.
And here's a report on activity on the Ithaca Frankenfood front. And this comes from the Ithaca Safe Food Campaign. A contingent of 8 from the Ithaca Safe Food Campaign visited Assemblyman Marty Lester's office for an hour on July 18th. To discuss the New York State GE Moratorium and Labeling Bill 9871, now sitting in the Agriculture Committee. Some of the people were scientists, farmers, concerned citizens, food writers, and cooks. Tony Del Plato, who was among the delegation, had the impression that Marty Lester was impressed with the directness and clarity of responses to his questions and the issues raised by each person who attended. 2 of Assemblyman Lester's legislative aides were present to take notes and research some of the info and the ideas the activists provided. Assemblyman Lester told the activists that he wanted to work with them and perhaps develop a labeling bill apart from the above legislation. The Ithaca Food Campaign suggests that as we approach the next legislative session, there is a need to maintain contact with Assemblyman Lester's office, so that the people will not be surprised again by legislative maneuvering on the bill. The following day, 9 other members of the Safe Food Campaign held a press conference supporting the nationwide effort to bring attention to the lack of labeling on GM foods. They also distributed info in the Ithaca Tops Plaza and at Wegmans grocery stores. 2 television stations, Ithaca Channel 7 and Elmira's Channel 36, sent reporters with cameras. The Ithaca Journal also covered the event, sending veteran reporter Stephen Landsman to do a story, which was printed in the July 20th Ithaca Journal. While the managers of Topps Market allow the activists to have their press conference and distribute literature unimpeded, Wegmans was a different story. Security was all over them in 30 seconds, telling them to leave. The group then moved the demonstration to the corner of Meadow and Titus Avenue with posters and received lots of friendly honks. Thanks to the Fishberries from Rochester for coming down to join the protest for this National Day of Action to call on all supermarkets and distributors to stop selling GM foods without labels. Also, a forum entitled Genetically Modified Food, Promises versus Reality will be held August 23rd, 7 p.m. Wednesday, at the Old Cooperstown Courthouse at 197 Main Street, Cooperstown. Panelists will be Sarah Johnson, Executive Director of NOFA New York, Nathan Battalion, Executive Director of Americans for Safe Food, and Tony Del Plato of the Ithaca Area Safe Food Campaign. For further info, call 607-783-2647 or 431-9577. Again, 607-783-2647 or 431-9577. The Ithaca Safe Food Campaign will organize a round table entitled Should There Be a Moratorium of Genetically Modified Foods on September 14th, Thursday, 7 p.m. at the Women's Community Building in Ithaca, New York. The round table is sponsored by Assemblyman Martin Luster and the Ithaca Area Safe Food Campaign. Cornell will be approached about co-sponsorship as well. This will be an event with presentations from both sides of the question about a GE food moratorium. The Ithaca Area Safe Food Campaign has a mailing list. If you're interested in joining it, write to T. Del Platt, T-D-E-L-P-L-A-T, at twcny.rr.com. T. Del Platt at twcny.rr.com.
Don't know good horse as we trot in this dark here, the Robin the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying.
The music in today's program was All You Fascists, performed by Billy Bragg with lyrics by Woody Guthrie, and City Don't Cry by Robert Plant and Jimmy Page.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by